Hey everyone, time to kick off another exciting DevOps Office Hours. It is May 17th, 2023. I'm Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock solid Terraform blueprints. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session with me by going to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and I'll show you exactly what your future can look like. For those of you new here, don't worry, our format is very informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those joining through our podcast or YouTube channel, you can watch these recordings by going to youtube.com/cloudposse or register for our live sessions by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to help and support what we are up to over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. Just go to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. So with that said, jumping into some announcements here. First one is CloudFlare looking to slurp up some of Amazon's on S3. CloudFront has a product called R2, which is API compatible with S3. And I'm guessing they're competing on price and availability and performance in some way. Keep in mind that S3 is not a CDN. It is just an object store. So I'm guessing when you combine Cloudflare with R2, you might get better object retrieval performance than you would get maybe with S3. But I'm just guessing since that's what Cloudflare is about. So Super Slurper is their service now to ingest all your data in S3. And I guess making it easier to jump ship. All right, next announcement is exciting from Terraform Cloud. So Terraform Cloud has been around for many years now. And they, it was HashiCorp's first real cloud service that they offered and has now become obviously part of the HashiCorp cloud platform. One of the biggest problems with Terraform Cloud since day one were the non-enterprise plans basically required you to hard code AWS root level credentials, admin credentials as environment variables to run anything. I don't know of any industry standard that says environment variables A are secure for secrets and B are secure for Amazon credentials that can be exfiltrated from any Terraform provider and sent anywhere. And that was the de facto story. Go enterprise, pay $200,000 a year. See you later. So that's led to, I think, the rise of a lot of other taco providers like Spacelift and N0 and Terra Team and Terra Hacks. And there's probably 15 or 20 of them out now. Well, I'm glad to say we can finally root a little bit more for Terraform Cloud because they are now not doing the SSO tax anymore. That has been a big criticism of a lot of platforms out there. And they're also bringing agents to the lower tiers. So let's see here, where was that? So Terraform's free tier now supports SSO and cloud agents. That makes it a viable solution now to start kicking the tires. If you've been wanting to use Terraform Cloud, now you can do that. So agents, why agents are valuable or required? Two reasons. You can use EC2 instance profiles so that those agents do not have any hard-coded AWS credentials, so that those credentials are just for the lifetime of well, for a short lifetime or the lifetime of that instance. And those credentials don't work outside of AWS, right? That's the other nice thing that they've done with IMDS V2. What else?
And also they can reach things that are non-API as well.
Exactly. So that's the next thing. So like if you're using Terraform to manage like Postgres users, and obviously you want your databases to be private, now you can do that. So you can holistically manage your infrastructure with Terraform Cloud, kick the tires, validate that it works for you, and then pay the $200,000. Joking. I think they've also done reductions in prices now. So it's based on now resources under management as opposed to workspaces or some of the other dimensions they've been pricing on. I don't know exactly how that works out, but it is kind of nice that it's now based on actually how much you're terraforming, maybe. And not successful applies. Yeah, that was the other dimension. It was successful applies. Who knows how many successful applies you have in a distributed team environment before you have a tool like Terraform Terraform Cloud in place that would give you that telemetry? You don't. So that made the pricing really hard to estimate. All right. Well, any more to add to that or questions before we move on to the next announcement? All right. Small announcement related to ChatGPT. OpenAI confirmed that someone was able to access data out of a Redis store that they were using for caching, or it was part of the product. Specifically, chats could have been accessed, and for some small percentage of users, even credit card information might have been compromised, I believe they said. Next announcement is a good one for enterprises and/or very large consumers of RDS Aurora. One of the problems that larger companies had with this is predictability of costs, and IO usage isn't a predictable variable in this case. So they're offering a tier of Aurora IO optimized instances that eliminate IO charges altogether. These instances are presumably, or these clusters are presumably starting at a much higher price point to bake in that constant. Another tool here, this was brought up by Jeremy on our team. We've seen similar tools for IAM, which can stream your CloudTrail logs and come up with least privileged IAM policies for services. There's also AWS IAM Access Analyzer. I think it does something similar. This is for Kubernetes called Audit to RBAC, and it's able to ingest the audit log, and then provided a username as an input, it will generate the appropriate RBAC role binding objects that will cover the API request made by that user. So getting a little bit more laser focused on permissions there. It was another one that caught my attention. I think it was pretty much just after office hours last week. Holy moly. This is just your monitoring platform. $65 million spent to Datadog by some mysterious company that's not mysterious anymore. So somehow Datadog landed this whale and it was, the crypto exchange. Blanking.
Coinbase,
yes, thank you. So it was when Coinbase was making money hand over fist and couldn't keep systems online and scale fast enough. So it was a kind, it sounded like it was a shut up, take our money kind of situation. And when they had to get a little bit more fiscally responsible as the price of Bitcoin dropped and everything else has happened. Yeah, apparently they amended it. So there, I think there's some misunderstandings on this one. Or easily misunderstood. So when they saw how much they were spending on Datadog, that gave them motivation to set up a Prometheus stack with Grafana. And I forget what the other components were. But it seems like an agreement was reached with Datadog. So they actually didn't put that into production, and they are still on Datadog, was my interpretation of the article, even though they threatened.
Yeah, they,
yes.
They, this whole thing actually came to light like during a Datadog earnings call. That's how the whole thing came. And the CEO of Datadog confirmed that they, the anonymous customer, he didn't name them, were still a customer. And he said that they've worked out a payment plan to spread out their bill over time and do something else to help them, and that they were going to continue to be a customer.
Makes sense. Yeah. All right. Next announcement was... HashiCorp has come out with some GitHub Action workflows and actions themselves to show you kind of how you, oh, here we go, to show you how you could integrate your infrastructure code with Terraform Cloud as part of your regular CI/CD workflows if you're already using GitHub Actions. This is a convenient pattern. We're starting to do the same now with like Spacelift, so you can trigger runs from other repos. This is kind of scary. First ever attack seen now in the wild of backdoors being planted in Kubernetes clusters. Apparently some rogue daemon sets getting deployed and provisioning some permissive RBAC rules. It's only a matter of time, I think, before we see more of these things. It's such a easy target. I mean, how many of us don't install Helm? We just install Helm charts all the time, right? And we don't necessarily look at what's getting deployed. And unlike Terraform, you know, Terraform, you're at least confirming, like, usually in the plan, everything that's going to happen before you deploy. But let's face it, with Helm, unless you're using Helm in Terraform, you're probably not auditing line by line everything that's going to change, doing a Helm diff before that deploy. So ripe for the picking. I linked this one because it was trending on Reddit. It's come up recently. What API gateway should we use on Kubernetes? I haven't had a chance to read through it. It just seemed apropos that this was trending on Reddit and somebody was just asking about this last week. I forget who, or the week before. So we'll share that in the Slack channel. We talked earlier, it's a month or two ago, about a kubectl subcommand that made it easier to debug or understand Kubernetes error messages and so forth. The problem with that being that you're sending all that potentially sensitive information to OpenAI. So someone's come up with a way of doing this locally, so you never need to actually, you know, let that information leave your VPC. And I think there's a little video here somewhere of it and it in action, forget where. All right, the last one, this was just something, Venkata, was it you who shared this? I saw it as I was putting the last notes together, something called Flamingo, a a newer project out of Flux?
Yeah, one of the folks that we recently interviewed mentioned it, and so I dug into it. I'm like, this looks cool, but wasn't sure if anyone was actually using it. It looked like Matt Gowey. I don't know if he's on this call or not. He had mentioned it, he had mentioned his team was looking at it. There was a caveat to it that I think he identified. I don't remember off the top of my head, but there's some stuff to be aware of that his team identified. So I think it's somewhere in the Slack channel. Let's see if we can bump it up to the front. But there, I don't remember the exact issue, unfortunately, but it may or may not impact you. It seemed like Flux and Argo, Argo CD may not just manage Flux. It doesn't work the way you think it might work, is my understanding, but I'd have to dig around for that GitHub issue.
Yeah, I don't know. I do remember there was a very short-lived partnership announced between Argo CD and Flux, but that was dead on arrival.
They both went their own separate ways. They were supposed to merge years ago, I think, and then I think it fell apart and Flux. It does look like this is pretty well maintained. Like it supports up to 2.6.7 when I checked on like for the underlying Argo CD version. It looks like it was 2.6.7 on the Flamingo Argo.
What I don't understand is why is this in a separate organization outside of WeWorks?
I didn't catch that actually. It's a good point. Yeah. That's odd.
Maybe WeaveWorks has a different way of handling like contributors and outside contributors to this versus like how they would have to manage them in their GitHub org.
That makes sense, yeah.
It looks like when you scroll back out, it looks like they added 2.7, which I didn't see the other day, so unless I missed it. But so that sounds promising. Looks well supported.
It looks like it's a release candidate that supports that. So it's still leading edge.
Yeah, it's true too. But yeah, I haven't played with it yet, so nothing really to report back on. I have not used Flux CD myself, but it seemed like you'd be able to get potentially the best of both worlds, be my hope, by using a tool like this.
So I don't have enough experience to understand the differences. To me, it seemed like Flux supported everything Argo CD already did and then had a lot more support for other things. Argo CD seemed like just a simpler setup to get up and running and what we've been supporting at Cloud Posse and working well. But I've always had a little bit of FOMO maybe on the side and like, well, should we have done Flux? Knowing also like there's plugins in Flux to do Terraform and other things.
Yeah, my understanding of Argo CD is one of the key differences is Helm template in Argo CD, whereas I believe Flux supports the functionality of Helm like all out of the box. If you've hit limits with Helm template, which we have on my team, Flux is supposedly a better solution to that. I'm not sure if anyone can see otherwise.
What are the problems you so? The way we implement it, we use Helm template or even sometimes Helm file that calls Helm template, but I haven't heard, but there's also native support for Helm charts in Argo. We just haven't been using it. What have you encountered?
In particular, there's one thing called the Helm function lookup or Helm lookup. So you can like look up values from a namespace or a config map. And it does not support that at all. But my let me rephrase that. You could always load in plugins to get that support. We haven't gone down that path. We're using the out of the box, off the shelf Argo CD installation. My understanding is on Flux, I should be able to do stuff like that, like leverage all the nooks and crannies that Helm has to offer.
Argo, at least as of 6 months ago, doesn't do Helm sync. It does, or Helm apply. It does Helm template only. and they've made wrappers to do things like hooks. So it can do Helm hooks, but it's not a native Helm hook. It's like interpolating the hook that Helm would normally do and doing it itself, while Flux has that direct support.
Yeah, I think
it also supports loading plugins through like a Nick container or something if you want to add extra Helm plugins. But for that specific use case, I'm using the Vals package directly in some cases to just template stuff, you know, replace values on the fly. And then I just check in the references. Yeah.
Is that a Vals package for Argo CD or Helm or?
No, I do it before I generate like the values file that gets checked in that Argo would actually be looking at.
Right? Oh, okay, got it. Cool. So, yeah.
To be honest, I didn't follow actually. What is this pattern using the Vals package?
So with Vals, you can like, and I think it's part of the Helm file project, but basically it just takes strings. It's like Helm file slash Vals. Yeah. It can take different strings and then it just runs like, if you scroll down a bit, it can talk to like, yeah. So
I remember this.
So in my CI, I'll run this in like a script and generate an actual values for some things, right? Mm. As opposed to if I wanted to modify, I could modify the Argo config and put the SSM Helm plugin in there if I felt like it, but I was a little bit lazy to do that. I might try it at a later point. But right now I run, like in the CI, I do some replacements with this, but yeah. I ran into your similar situation though. I saw there was like a Helm SSM plugin, but it wasn't in Argo. So my workaround for that particular thing, rather than doing the init container stuff, was to run this and then just generate the values. And then for secrets, I'm using external secrets operator, so I don't have to worry about checking that in. I do use this for secrets manager though, and some Bootstrap scripts that I just like run manually.
Very cool.
And they have an action for this also. They didn't have like brew or anything, which was disappointing. I did compile it for my Mac, but there is a GitHub action that does the caching for it and stuff like that.
For what it's worth, I'm not a big user or haven't really used either one of these, but I've talked to like extensively. But I talked to one of my friends who told me that Flux doesn't have, excuse me, by default, Flux doesn't have a UI, like it's all API based. And there's like a Weaveworks specific like GitOps UI you could use for it, or there's actually like an integration with VS Code, and you can do all of the work like through a VS Code plugin or whatever, but there isn't like a native.
That's the primary reason Argo is not more, Argo is more adopted in the businesses, is because there's a UI. That's definitely the primary reason. When I've talked to different teams, that's why.
Yeah, that's what, like, talking to my friend, he told me too.
the UI definitely demos well.
Also. Yeah. Or if you have a lot of, if you're SRE or DevOps team, but have a lot of users who need to understand how their servers are being promoted, a UI is very handy to visualize that for them, rather than saying, hey, go look at the API or making your own UI.
So I've seen that UI that Weaveworks has. I assume that was part of the Flux project, and that's why it was even harder for me to understand. So I think that was a real clarifying point for me, that Flux is basically headless at this point.
Yeah.
The open source model. Okay. Awesome. All right. Any more on this topic? Should we move on to the next one? Oh, that was my last one. Any announcements I missed? Anything else come across your radar this week, guys and gals?
I have a very small one that I don't know if we've ever talked about it before, but I found this command line utility called tfsort. I don't know. It basically, it's basically a CLI that will sort you pass it either your variables or your outputs file, and it will just alphabetically sort them for you, which when you're building large modules is really handy to put everything in alphabetical order so you can find out where the hell things are without having to search for them. So you can still scroll.
Yeah, that's a good one. We've definitely talked about it, but recirculation is always good.
Have we? Yeah, I don't remember, but and I don't ever remember seeing it before. I had been doing it mostly manually, which was a pain, but yeah, that's it.
My history here. I think it was on, it was in the weekly TF issue 115
or whatever. Oh, I have no idea.
All right.
Yeah, I was about to write a script to do it, and then I Googled instead of doing that work, and I was like, oh man, there's already something that does exactly what I want.
There's been a lot of great little Terraform, little helper utilities coming out lately. Lots of probably weekend Golang learning projects.
Yeah. So I find it helpful. I'm working on a couple of modules that have tons of inputs and outputs, and it makes it much clearer for me, at least in my perspective, to sort them alphabetically.
Yeah. Cool. Any other announcements this week, folks?
You guys, this is Amer. I don't know if you can hear me. One thing I wanted to share is caught my eye yesterday. Many users of Alpine Linux in Kubernetes have had issues with the DNS over TCP because of the library that's being used, I guess, by the Alpine. Not using glibc, instead using musl library. And that has been fixed now. I'll post the article in the Zoom chat. On my previous role, I had issues with that actually. So with Alpine 3.18 seems like that's now been fixed. Cool. These DNS over TCP. Like if you Google, what like major reason why people suggested against using Alpine on Kubernetes workloads, even more so in EKS on AWS, this pops up like in the top results in Google. So it was.
And just what nice was the symptom with this DNS issue? Was it like routing to the wrong?
No, 404 or NS not found.
I was returning 404. I can find you one other article and I'll share in the meeting.
So basically the authoritative name server that it needed to query over TCP wouldn't respond over UDP, so you would just get no answer.
So if I had like an Nginx talking to a backend and I recycled the backend and it experienced that issue, would that be like a 500 hang or something?
It would result in whatever that upstream was not being resolvable. Like that host name does not exist. Okay. Even though it clearly exists when you try and resolve it using any other mainstream tool.
So not like resolve to old or wrong.
Yeah.
Just
flat out not resolve at all.
Gotcha.
And it's because however DNS was implemented in that platform and the resolver was expecting UDP, well, it was expecting TCP requests for DNS, and UDP is the most common. So it was a reasonable assumption, I think, that Alpine made to do DNS over UDP only. I don't know when DNS over TCP became more common, but.
Yeah, like what my personal firewall, I'm running OPN Sense on a little appliance, and pretty much all my DNS traffic is over UDP. So I guess at some point there's different change in Alpine. This article on the register suggests that like majority other Linux distributions actually use the other library, which was not having that issue.
Well, thanks for
DNS over TCP is more common when you're doing just when you have very large DNS packets.
Yeah, it became much more popular first when Kerberos authentication under Windows started triggering oversized DNS packets. So we started to see a lot more protocols that auto switched. Because the packets were larger. About 20 years ago, we started to see a lot of it. You know, like maybe 0.5% of DNS traffic.
Yeah, and that, and now when you have like a CDN and they're sending, you know, 20 hosts for the same, you know, for the same A record, you know, the package is bigger than
although it's kind of wild, wild west now, because you have a lot of DOA DNS over HTTP. You know, in because the providers on a large scale started selling access to DNS fix-ups. So the ISPs were using people like Infoblox. Infoblox has a whole sort of sideline business with the ISPs where they will hijack the DNS. They don't talk about it in the enterprise products. But if you get to the provider products at Infoblox, they rewrite DNS on a large scale on the provider level as a core business feature. And then as people did that, they started using DOA, DNS over HTTP, to keep their provider from overwriting their DNS.
Yeah, I also think it has something to do with the DNSSEC protocol too, when they run DNS over TLS with secure DNS updates and all that kind of stuff. There's no way to do that over UDP.
Oh, that makes sense. Man, learning so much today. Cool. Next, I guess that was all I had in terms of announcements. So then why don't we go into...
Just before we go too far, that maybe we should just bring up the thing that I posted internally about GitHub Actions and set output and everything as a public service message. A link. I just posted it in the Zoom. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. So this is imminent. And there are so many actions that have not been updated for set output, especially.
And also the Node 12 deprecation is in a few days, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, except that probably won't be as bad, because they're just going to roll it onto like a different version of Node. And most things are probably going to continue to run. But this one I see is going to break tons and tons of like actions that people rely on. So if you use set output under the hood, which tons of actions that I've seen still do, it's been warning for some time now, but now those are all going to turn to failures. So your workflows are all going to fail if those are in there. So check your upstream workflows that you're using to see if they use set output anywhere. And then
they should be warning you if you're calling something.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like check your logs now to see if anything is warning. And then talk to those package maintainers, or see if there's newer versions from those package maintainers that have already updated past this. Otherwise, your GitHub Action workflows are going to break on June 1st.
And the fix is super easy. It's basically just this one line. You just got to change it from this to this, and you're done.
Yeah, it has some gotchas.
What are the new lines?
We had problems with new lines in the values. If you have new lines in the values, it breaks. I don't know. Yeah,
it's because you're echoing it to an environment variable now. That's like what ends up happening. And specifically, like if you have new lines, or if you have special characters or some other things, it's not as simple to make this work. There was even a case that when I wrote the Atmos describe affected GitHub action workflow, I just could not get this to work no matter what I did. So I ended up like writing it to a file and then reading it back from a file in a different step as we needed it, because I couldn't get it to work with the new output. And it was working with set output. So I don't quite know what the root cause of that one was, but I didn't let myself get hung up on it. But I've definitely seen multiple times when there are line breaks and other special characters that it sometimes throws this for a loop.
There's this printf, which is like echo but supports multiple specifiers, and one is %q will do shell escaping. So yeah. This would work 99% out of the box on GitHub Actions, because it's standard in every image. And then instead of just doing echo in the very like this here, you just use the name equals percent Q and then your variable here, and it should be properly escaped.
There was something even with that didn't work, and I don't remember what it was, but I tried that, and I tried a here doc and inserting it in a here doc, and that didn't work either. No matter what I did, I couldn't get one scenario to work. I'd have to look back at my notes to figure out exactly what it was, but I figured out a workaround, so I went with the workaround. So, but most of the time, it's a very simple fix. I agree with you.
Another note on that is if you're using abandoned old actions, they might not have been updated. You might need to refactor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or fork the action into your repo and change it and do what you need to do.
We were presently surprised. We've been waiting for a bunch of updates to some of the review dog actions, and we saw action suggester, which is a really awesome little action which will automatically suggest changes based on a standardized diff output. So if you have a command that will modify files and then you can run a diff on it, action suggester will now comment on the pull request, for example, with suggested changes here. So you don't have to modify the branch itself. Anyways, this one had the set output problem as well. And it was recently updated. Well, what? This doesn't show any changes. Must have been another action I was thinking about. Never mind. Disregard. All right. Q&A. Matt, are you on the call today?
No, but I am. So that's good. I'm working with Matt, so.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Awesome, Emil.
Yeah.
So are you familiar with the question he had? Okay.
We had a lot of good answers in the chat, so that was very helpful.
Okay. What did you guys decide on?
Right now it looks like we're gonna use the SAM just for the deployment part and the local development part, and try to keep as much as possible in Terraform. Like, we don't have that many lambdas that we need to transfer, so it's just want to enable the devs to do their own stuff and then push their own repo. So trying to do as much of the API gateway, just for our context for other people, we're trying to like deploy an API gateway and then trying to figure out where's the boundary point between Terraform and API gateway, and what do we deploy with which tool? Yeah. So yeah, it's not an easy question.
There's been at least you're not doing, what I don't like is where you're building the lambdas as local execs inside of the Terraform. That is not nice.
Yeah, we were thinking just deploying like this basic yellow word lambda in the Terraform and then deploying on top of it using SAM. On the ECR, but if other people have a suggestion of what they've to use and what worked well for them, I'd be interested to know.
Well, yeah, I've done a fair amount of work around this, and I basically would say that the pattern I found to work the best with Terraform for this is create your lambdas and all of that like in Terraform, but the actual code itself, like deploy for like, have your CI process build the artifact in the zip, store it in S3, and then when you run Terraform, you just bump the version of the artifact that you want to deploy, and then actually have Terraform deploy the artifact for you. And then that works pretty well. Like, and you can orchestrate that pretty well inside your pipeline, and it stays with the IAC pattern pretty well, and you don't get drift and all of that kind of thing. So we've tried a bunch of different ways, and it's not great, but that one's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I did similar, and I used Atmos, and I did like YQ inline edits to replace a Simber in the S3 folder path, and or SHAs in the folder path and stuff like that. Yeah. For the zip files.
Yeah.
Yeah. In one project that I did that with, what I ended up doing was had the CI tool actually write the version that should be deployed to a param store parameter. And then Terraform read that. So when you run drift detection, it would see like, oh, you know, this, you could either kick it off as part of your job, or if you have like drift detection running, it would say like, oh, you're running version one. It says you should be running version two. So then it would deploy version two for you, like automatically, that kind of thing. So just one way.
Can I offer another perspective and maybe with some insight on the way that your Lambdas are, or I guess the teams who are developing the Lambdas versus the teams who might be owning the infrastructure. And I mean, that's a preface to my experience with this being on a team that was more DevOps associated. We deployed all of the infrastructure, we used Terraform, et cetera, et cetera. But we worked with a development team that was developing the actual applications that they were developing the Lambdas and needed to access the API gateways. And so what we found is we'll use our flow, which was a totally separate CI/CD process, to deploy all of the plumbing, quote unquote, networks, buckets, you know, that type of stuff, permissions and all that kind of stuff. And then the developers would use those values as inputs to their CI process, or read them from parameter store when they deployed, so that they could deploy more often than we could probably deploy our, I mean, we could run our Terraform as often, but I guess what I'm saying is they could deploy their stuff on their CI pipeline without having to run our CI pipeline to deploy the artifact. So that just kept things a little more agile for them, and not having to run two CI pipelines. They just ran their one to deploy.
I had similar setup. Like, we would do the databases and the more static stuff, but for Lambdas, we had some Terraform components that we wrote, and we just exposed the Atmos YAML, and they could just define Lambdas and stuff in there and API gateways.
Yeah, the problem that we ran into was when the Lambda code needed to create its own policies and permissions specifically. So it was creating, it wasn't creating users, but it was creating policies and permissions to access different stuff.
We let them create it, and we just reviewed their PRs.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what we fell down to. That's what I was getting to the point was, like, we had very stringent guidelines for what we could deploy, as far as like naming conventions and permissions allowed and that type of stuff. So the developers got in there and it was the Wild West. They were like, hey, we can do whatever. But when our account was reviewed by security, we caught the flack for their, you know, egregiousness, you know, their oversteps on
TFSec is another good one for the PR check for that, like looking at the policies and stuff that can help automate that. But we reviewed it. We had TFSec, some stuff in there, and we also looked at them.
Well, basically we just came down to, we had a close relationship with the development team. So we worked out, you know, the changes that they needed to make. And as far as naming conventions, permission boundaries, and all that kind of stuff, to the point where we can get everything accepted by security and still have our own independent, you know, CI processes. And they could be as agile as they wanted to be. We could be as agile as we wanted to be. And it all kind of worked out. We were happy. So anyway, just offering another sort of viewpoint to an approach.
Yeah, like that. It's interesting. Like, I wasn't sure like where to put the line on it. I would like to be able to deploy the Lambda without having to change the Terraform code. So I don't know with that. I will have to check. But maybe the compromise.
That's why I was suggesting using a param store, because that way the CI can build the artifact and put the, you know, the version of that artifact, whether it's a SHA or a tagged version or whatever, into that parameter store parameter. And then basically your Terraform can read which version of the Lambda to deploy from there, and then read that out of an S3 bucket, or, you know, download that artifact from GitHub Action or from GitHub artifacts or some other artifact store, basically, and then upload it for Lambda. So.
Yeah. And using that approach, you don't change the Terraform per se. You just have to run it.
You just have to apply it.
In our case, we didn't want, I mean, we got pretty close to letting them, but we didn't want the development team running our pipelines in the odd rare case that there was some sort of, you know, exception that they didn't know how to handle. We would, you know, have to handle it anyway. So That's what we kind of divided things.
There's also automation that you could do there. So like if you're running like Spacelift as an example, you could basically after your CI pipeline builds, you could then use Spacecuddle to trigger like the actual deployment of the Terraform stack, like that specific individual Terraform stack. Or if you're using GitHub Actions, you can use like a workflow dispatch to dispatch the other workflow that actually runs the Terraform from the CI code, from the developer CI that's building the artifact and storing the new version up there. So that way you don't need human intervention to do any of that.
And if you do, if you don't update basically the Lambda from the Terraform, you're going to get a drift because the version, right, it's going to always get.
Yeah, it will change. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yep. Okay. We'll have to check that, but good stuff.
All right. Any other questions we can get to today?
Hello. I have a question. As a person who is very new to open source, I am very grateful to be here among very bright people, of course. What would be the recommended roadmap in order to become a valuable contributor to your project of Cloud Plus Set?
Well, one of the things that definitely catches our eye is regular contributors to our open source and our pull requests. One of the best ways to being seen is making any of those pull requests and posting them in the PR reviews channel on our Slack team. If you're just getting started what is your longer term objective? Is it to, level up career-wise? Is it to, become more adept at Terraform or anything?
It would be, of course, upgrade my career level and basically later join Cloud Plus Set.
All right. I think then the best way is, being visible. We recognize a lot of the regulars in our community and the contributors and so forth. I'll be honest, I don't know what to call it, like a personality trait or an aptitude. Usually it's hard just to contribute to open source projects unless there is a business driver for it. Like, well, in your work, you need these things. So that's why you're contributing it. You're expanding it. But it's pretty hard just taking, off the random issues that people open up and, implementing a fix because it's not really solving a problem that you yourself are facing. So I think the most important thing is first figure out, in your day job presently, how will this open source benefit you? And then how would you like to extend it? And then we're overloaded with pull requests, but we're always merging pull requests every single week. So if you promote them and they're adding value, yeah, that's the best way. Matt, any other suggestions? Jeremy, White, any other suggestions?
Yeah, I would, if you're really just getting started, I would start with things that are, simple changes so you get used to the process, things like, documentation contributions or small bug fixes or that kind of thing. I wouldn't try to tackle like adding major features or refactoring modules or whatever until you have some experience under your belt with the ecosystem. But doing that, and then like Eric mentioned, like on our SweetOps Slack organization, we have a specific channel called PRs. Just make sure that you, drop it in there so that someone can, take a look and review your work. And then I would say the biggest thing just for that is if you open PRs and do it, I know it's a labor of love for some people. You're not getting paid for this. But if we give like feedback or any of that kind of thing, like follow up on the feedback, like take suggestions, and take it to completion, because oftentimes you'll see someone who makes an initial effort and then realizes like, that's too hard. And then you have this half done work out there. And that makes the job of the overall community even harder to figure out rather than easier. So only tackle things if you think you can bring it to completion too. That would be my other advice.
This is very helpful. Thank you. Thank you a lot.
Thank you, Rin. So I have a question for everyone. Maybe there won't be any takers on this one. I'm just curious. Is anyone doing fine-grained Terraform state management access using S3? By fine-grained, I mean teams or roles that can plan only certain states and others that can plan and apply certain states. So I'm looking for something more granular than by account. So not just saying, hey, if you're in the dev account, you got full access to plan and apply dev. But you know, as an organization grows and you have, you know, 15 different teams possibly sharing a single dev account, arguments can be made that you should have more accounts. I accept that. But the point is more, how can we, within a single account, across multiple different accounts, have different levels of access controls on Terraform objects, Terraform state.
Yeah, I do that.
State buckets. Not that I'm running it, just came to mind. I don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, the point of delineation for this problem isn't state bucket, because you need to give some people read access and some people write access to pieces of state buckets, and it can't exactly be like provision or divided that way. Like that was the first thing that we looked at when we've been debating this problem a lot internally. So we're curious to hear if anyone externally has any good suggestions of how to accomplish it.
Well, I was wondering, like, it almost feels to me like you would move the access or the permissions above the bucket. And it seems like this would be something, I don't know if you're using a space lift or Terraform Cloud or whatever the case is, but something that you would put at the user's permission level or like a group level.
Yeah, so we have engineers that are actually running like Terraform or Atmos directly, like in the geodesic like shell. So this isn't even necessarily with one of the, you know, the taco providers out there.
I mean, to be clear, it needs to be, you know,
both, yeah,
friendly with doing command line operations, and it needs to be friendly in a automated fashion, a la GitHub Actions, Space Lift, Terraform Cloud, etc.
Got it. So you're saying if you could like sort of abstract those permissions away to the bucket level, then whoever touches the bucket is kind of accounted for because the permissions are in place before they even think about them or know about them.
I think if you imagine it, like, let's say in every account we provision, you know, like a logs bucket. Let's just use that as an example. Something that's real simple to grok. We want to be able to give certain people access to read the state for the logs bucket because they might need to know like the arm of that logs bucket. But they shouldn't be able to actually like destroy, update, do anything to that log bucket, to the state for that log bucket we're talking mm-hmm. about, not the actual log bucket itself. And then we want to give other people like the super admins or the platform engineers or whatever, the ability to read and write that state. And that's just one like little microcosm. We want to be able to do that kind of at a component or group of components level across what turns out to be like thousands of components for the organization. So we want to be able to use some sort of pattern matching or something that's easy to implement there. So we've talked and gone round and round on many solutions, and we haven't come up with a good one. So I think
they have to, is a requirement that they have to run Terraform CLI to view this state? Or
yeah, it's because people are doing development like of Terraform modules and things, and they need to be able to be empowered to do the work that they're trying to do, but not break the things that they shouldn't be able to break.
Well, if you can only look at it, I would say that isn't there more convenient ways to just look in Terraform CLI? And then at that point, it's like,
it's like state too, right? So like you might be using remote state to look up other values and do those kinds of things. So
for example, like
to actually, I get you. So to actually like use those variables in other portions of the world.
Yeah.
So
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I feel like by the time, I mean, I totally get it because you might want, you have people that may be using the same bucket to do whatever they do, but there's something else in that bucket or even in a remote state that they need to read. But I feel like, I don't know, my naive approach is just like some permission that says Terraform apply XYZ on this plan and the apply returns or the plan returns. You can't do that, you know, as opposed to reading the bucket maybe because they have permission to do that. So they have the current state, but then going to write it and then the Terraform fails with an error that says, oh, I can't, you know, do whatever I need to do because of some, you know, obscure permission, which basically translates to I can't write to the bucket. Or even if before you get to writing the bucket or writing the state, what about the API calls that it's make to making to already modify the resource? So that's what I'm trying to get above or before you even try to do any sort of apply.
Well, the first thing that it does in the Terraform lifecycle is make sure that it has access to the state bucket. Like it reads the backend.json and then checks its permissions for that. So it will actually tell you. So if you're doing a plan, it checks to see that it has read permissions to those, you know, to those things. So you won't get into some state where it's like the other way around. Like that's actually up front in the Terraform lifecycle if you look at how it actually plans and applies things. But yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is what we want. The problem is there's no native Terraform like feature that says to do what you just said, like check to see if you could, you know, you could read these things, and no easy way to grant to set those permissions without, you know, without doing something like crazy at the bucket level right now.
Well, not at the bucket level. You've got to base it on prefix.
That's what I mean. Inside the bucket. Sorry, I didn't mean like.
So that's what I'm doing at the level. Link I provided is just with n teams. There's n prefixes, and they all get buckets like prefix specific access. And there's a global path where people can reference global stacks and cross reference like
so,
that.
So you're basically just
manual
re-architecting your buckets so that they align to those permission boundaries, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's the same bucket for every stack, which is, if you ask anyone at HashiCorp what they thought about it, they'd throw napalm at it. But
yeah.
The functionality that we're asking for, that they want.
Yeah.
Their whole goal is to build all of this stuff into Terraform Cloud so you can pay for it.
Yeah. So Paul, I see you just mentioned S3 object tags. Unfortunately, the S3 backend doesn't support object tags. There's been a pull request open for 2 years to merge to add those, and it hasn't been merged for 2 years. So I don't know why. that was my first thing that I said we should try it, and unfortunately, it doesn't work.
I mean, it's such a simple PR. Like, could you just give it to us?
Yeah.
But you said there were other complications I heard afterwards, like put requests or something don't respect.
Well, this works because it's setting the tags like on every.
Oh, so this would work.
Like, yeah, this works. What we were trying to do, we were going to try to hack it outside of the Terraform lifecycle, where the first, basically we were going to run like some sort of an event that every time a file was written, we were going to go add the object tags like back to it. But then the problem is that like literally every Terraform state like apply does a put of the new file. Like they create a file on disk and then they put that file to remote state. That's like actually how it works. And then when you put, if you don't specify the tags in the put command, it deletes the tags that were there on the previous version of that file, essentially.
I was gonna say, well, now S3 buckets support like lambdas, right, on objects or something, but
yeah,
there's life cycles as well.
Yeah, we could for sure use like event bridge basically, and like every time an object is written to there, we could write the tag to it. But I thought of that too, but that gets into the same. My other recommendation, as we talked about, was that we could write a small HTTP server that enforces all the permissioning and then writes to S3, because HTTP is a backend, but both that and the Lambda that we're talking about are then custom solutions that are kind of like hacking the, you know, the backend process. So I'm not sure that that's great, but
they're going to something like console, right?
Yeah. Or
looked
that's
at it. Right. We wouldn't solve it. We looked into it.
Yeah. There's still some debate on whether it would solve it or not, but yeah, it's not easy either.
All right. Well, we are at the end of the hour, everyone. Thanks for entertaining the conversation here on fine-grained access. The saga continues. We'll let you guys know what we come up with. If you haven't yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, please do go to youtube.com/cloudposse to subscribe. That helps us out a great deal. We also have lots of other resources. If you're interested in all the links that we share on office hours, subscribe to our newsletter at newsletter.cloudposse.com. We also have our Slack community at slack.cloudposse.com. Very active community, great place to get help. And if you are learning Terraform, asking questions and so forth, connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/in/Osterman. I love to connect with everyone here in our community. Lastly, if you think the way you do Terraform could be improved a little bit, reach out. We can solve a lot of your problems. We've done it 1,000 times. We have some pretty awesome blueprints for how to elevate Terraform usage and adoption at your company. Go to cloudposse.com/quiz to book a session with me.